So, Rage, what are we doing today?
The beginning is a very difficult time.
What?
Mark, you totally sidestepped the question, man.
Know then that it is the year 1984. The film Dune is directed by David Lynch. In this film, the effects are great for the era, and the soundtrack was written by Toto, those guys who did the song Africa. The cast is all-star. Even Sting isn't half bad.
Are you monologuing again?
Producer Dino De Laurentiis and his menagerie of directors have never been able to make the film over the course of 10 years.
You're pretty much front-loading the review, Rage.
Right. So, what are we actually going to talk about?
The film went on to be a box office bomb, grossing only $30.9 million out of $40 million budget, not including marketing.
Mark, you're killing the episode.
Oh, yes. And then there's the matter of the story, which starts off fine, but then...
Okay, I'm pulling the plug on this. Stop the intro before you blow the whole episode. Thomas, cue the music. Sci-Fi Malady, Symptom 175, David Lynch Dune, There's Rain on Arrakis?
Okay, welcome back, sickies, to our new month, Dune December. We're closing out 2020, thank God, with a theme that, quite honestly, I can't believe we haven't done before, because Dune is such a monumental IP in science fiction. And honestly, the motivation for this theme was that the new Dune film, directed by Denis Villeneuve of Blade Runner 2049 fame, was supposed to have come out this month. But thanks to COVID, it will not be released until 2021 and probably only on HBO Max. So that is a downer for everybody who was hoping to see it. But nonetheless, we are trudging on. We will be watching the David Lynch Dune, the Sci-Fi Channel Dune series, and then we'll be doing another little interesting review of the Jaworski Dune that never really got made, but we'll get to that. And then we'll be closing out the year with kind of comparing Dune series and any other rips and picks that we like to close out in the year. So that's what you could look forward to ahead. But getting on to this episode today, we're going to be covering 1984 David Lynch Dune. And Scott's going to be kind of our expert here, as he is the biggest Dune fan of us all. Isn't that right, Scott?
That would be accurate. It's definitely a sci-fi essential. I've read just about everything Dune related. I think there might be some of the school of Dune books that have been released recently that I might have missed. I think the last one I read was Sisterhood of Dune. It got tough when in one of the last books, Paul ran off to join the circus. Literally, he ran off to join the intergalactic circus. But Dune is a fantastic series up until you get to anything written in the last 5 years. Definitely go ahead and read the original 6 books by Frank. Read the first 3 books written by Brian and Kevin J. Anderson. Maybe the Butlerian Jihad Chronicles, and then stop. Just stop. Because Hunters of Dune and Sandworms of Dune will make you do what I did, which is throw the book across the room and curse. Literally the only time I've ever done that, I threw the book across the room and started cursing, called Mark and said, after 20 books and 10,000 pages, it wasn't even about an Atreides. It's all about Duncan Idaho. And I liked the character of Duncan Idaho until that moment.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, I know, right?
That's what about we do.
The Machine Crusade?
Yeah, that's part of the Butlerian Jihad. You can go ahead and read that. Those are pretty good novels that show you how the feud between the Harkonnens and the Atreides start, and it shows you why they're so obsessed with not making a machine to mimic the mind of a man, and it explains how the Ix develops and how you get some of how the Bene Gesserit come about. You find a lot of how the Spacing Guild begins and the Navigators faster than light speed travel. They're very good books with backstory. So that's why I said include the Machine Crusade and the Butlerian Jihad books. And then just don't read the Paul of Dune and the Mentats of Dune and the Sisterhood of Dune. Just stop there. They'll just make you angry.
Okay, so that is a brief review of the books, but we're going to focus on the films. And Particularly, we're going to start with the first film in the series, I should say, 1984's David Lynch Dune. Now, one of the things I've noticed is that Dune is not necessarily, though it's a fantastic IP and very original and unique, it is not monetarily the most successful, because if you're going to, first of all, it's not very sexy. There's not a lot of awesome martial arts action, 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 and space battle go boom. It's a lot more slow, plodding, methodical, political detail intrigue with weapons that you have to use a knife because technology has gotten to the point where using a laser on a shield is a horrible idea and it'll kill us all.
Yeah, just it's an atomic blast.
Yeah, so you kind of have to use knives again. That's the best weapon in a one-on-one fight. So, and the book Dune itself, I know from the very little I've read and from Scott and some other friends that it's not laden in conflict. They'll spend 20 pages getting ready for a battle, and the battle is given a paragraph, if that. So, that tends to take away from the Hollywood blockbuster. Either you're going to be doing the film correctly, accurately, and it's super long and gets no butts in seats, or you're going to do it the sexified version and it's a bad film.
I think you can do Dune very well, but not in a movie. Anytime you attempt to bring Dune to the silver screen, you're going to run into a time constraint. Even if you made a 3-hour movie or an Avengers-esque 3.5-hour movie, you can't. Or was Avengers 3 hours? Was Endgame 3 hours?
I don't remember. It was like 2.5. But yeah. Then you have to consider the other films of the series.
Even if you made Dune into a 3-hour movie, you're still going to be doing massive exposition dumps like you do in the 1984 Dune and character soliloquies where you're hearing their thoughts, because Frank created a unique world, and not just a unique world. He created a unique galaxy with it, a backstory like George Lucas claims that he had. Frank had an actual real backstory to all of this and created a culture and a religion and a new form of government and a new economy. You know, and he merged. Yeah. And to explain all of this, you had tons of pages within the book to work with. You don't have that in a screen. So you've got to get that information out to people quickly. And exposition dumps make for bad storytelling. But if you did this in a Netflix series or an Amazon Prime original where you had 10 episodes, and you could run those episodes from anywhere from 55 minutes to an hour and a half, depending on what you needed to do. And you could tell book one over a full series and then move into book two and three over another two or three seasons. You could successfully adapt Dune to the screen. There is a lot of hand-to-hand combat, so you absolutely could make that exciting. You could get, Game of Thrones has shown that political intrigue can be exciting and backroom negotiation and maneuvering. So I do believe that you could do Dune justice and make it the next Game of Thrones but only in a 8-10 episode season type of framework. If you try to do it another way, you're screwed.
It's a very tricky property to try to do a rush job on.
Plus, you got to bring someone in to rewrite all of the dialogue. You need to take the points of Frank Herbert's story, but Frank was terrible at dialogue. He was a great world builder. He's one of those guys we talked about who can definitely build a world, but he can't write dialogue to save his life.
His dialogue is unrealistic, let's say the least.
Yeah, and sometimes it's not consistent for the character from line to line. Sometimes he's just throwing lines at a character that it's not that character.
Yeah, it doesn't ever really feel like A, it's either that's what the character would say, or B, that's what any person would say.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and we're going to see that kind of with this first film here today. Now, I don't think we're going to really get into the production information like you would if you were watching, for example, Midnight's Edge on YouTube or something like that. The production notes that I think we wanted to say we're in the intro, honestly.
Yes.
I think we want to look pretty much at the film itself, its merits, and compare it to the book. Because as I say in the intro, it starts off pretty faithful. It starts off pretty darn faithful, and then somewhere around hour and 40 minutes, this is a 2 hour and 17 minute film, somewhere around hour and 30, hour and 40 minutes, it takes a sharp turn and just leaves the rest, because it's almost like the director and writer realized, and the director and writer is the same person, David Lynch, but they, like, he suddenly realized, uh-oh, I have to finish this thing in an hour. Or he was told he had to. And he realized, I don't have enough to talk about Paul Muad'Dib taking his revenge back. There's not enough time. I spent all of my time setting up the world and getting Paul and Lady Jessica out into the desert with the Fremen. And now I have no time for that angle, for that thread. So that's what I think it looks like.
Go ahead, Tom.
I was just going to say, it doesn't help that, again, with this book, there is so much in there that has to be described. Sure. Because this isn't like a common sense idea that we understand. This is an entirely new universe that he has to explain what spice is.
Right.
What the entire political system is, family structure, the idea of entire planets, structure, trade going on here, religions going on in this universe. Because
right.
All of this stuff has importance. And he has to somehow explain all this and then also get the people where they need to be and then be like, ah, crap, I have to end this?
Yeah, right.
And
yeah,
it's impossible. They never explain Chome, the Combine House's over-advanced mercantiler. I'm not sure if I even got that right. And the Landstrad and the balance between the Houses of Chome and the Landstrad and the Emperor and their directorship rights against the Spacing Guild, which has a monopoly on spice and the travel.
There's an entire treaty system between empires and the Emperor and the Houses.
Right. It's reverted to an intergalactic feudal empire. And you try to explain that as quickly as you can, and you can't. And then the problem at the ending there is there's a lot of political negotiation that goes on again in that throne room on Arrakis, where Princess Irulan is wed to Paul. The Emperor is going to forfeit all of his voting shares in Chome and the Landstrad, and he's going to be exiled to his prison planet on Seleucus Secundus. And he sets up... he inherits the Emperor's votes by marrying the princess, and he changes the balance of the Landstrad, renegotiates with the Spacing Guild. None of that's going to work on TV after 2 hours. You just got to accelerate it through.
You haven't even explained most of those factions. This isn't like Star Wars, where you have Empire bad, ruling the world like fascists bad. I can get that. Rebellion fighting them good. Okay, I dig. Force, okay, so it's basically magic and these space wizards defended everything. Okay, cool, I'm good. That's all I need.
Yeah.
Whereas this, you can't even do something like, well, think of the future as like the Holy Roman Empire. Well, that would involve people knowing how the political machinations of the Holy Roman Empire were.
Right.
Honestly, the Holy Roman Empire at some point might actually make more sense than this universe. Because again, at least then you go, well, it's on Earth. And there's some limitations. It only existed in this limited area. And this one, it's like, oh, yeah, it's across multiple planets. There's hundreds of years of history. I mean, we're talking the main character here. And again, main character of this movie is tied to how many centuries old breeding program?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the Bene Gesserit's been history. It's a 10,000-year breeding program to get to this point. And Jessica decides to screw the whole thing up by having a son instead of a daughter.
Yeah. Which they established that. But, you know, we're kind of getting into it. So let's...
I might have missed this in my rewatch of 1984 Dune. Do they ever announce in that movie that Lady Jessica is a Harkonnen?
No.
She's a Harkonnen. No.
Yeah.
That's a huge thing. Because that means Paul is half Harkonnen.
Yeah.
That is a huge thing that they need to get to.
Which, again, in this universe, means something.
So, we're kind of already doing it. So, I think before we get into any kind of rips and picks, I'm not going to talk about the plot because it's a lot. And I think we'll cover the plot by doing this. Let's compare the book to the film. And I think, and after that, we'll do our rips and picks. And I think the first big one to me is the fact that Paul, now correct me if I'm wrong, Scott, Paul had no intention of destroying the spice.
No, Paul sees two paths. And, you know, he tries to walk the path that his son Leto won't. Paul believes that he can control the spice and avoid the death and destruction that Leto is going to bring about, walking his making his choice. Paul's going to release the jihad, where he's going to take control of everything, and a lot of people are going to die, but it's a better path than the one that Leto is going to take. Paul definitely needs there to be the spice, but he wants it to be under his control, not destroyed.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that then, at the end, you have Rain on Arrakis. Well, they don't establish this anywhere in the film, but water is basically acid to sandworms. And sandworms, they make spice, correct?
Correct. You can't have spice without the sandworms.
Well, yeah, and they make that clear in the film. There's a connection, but they don't explain how. So because they sidestep that and take...
Time out.
Yeah.
Time out. I'm just going to say, I don't know if everyone... again, because I don't know how many of our viewers will have actually...
Okay, that's a point. That's a point. So
you might want to actually describe what spice is.
Yeah, you're right. You're completely right. So basically, the universe in the year 10199 is ruled by what would amount to a Holy Roman Empire type confederation. There's an emperor, but this guy has to share power with a group of houses called the, what was it, Scott?
The Landstrat.
Yeah, and there's also another faction called the Bene Gesserit, who are, well,
witches. They call
them witches in here. But think of them more like...
religious cult, maybe?
Yeah.
Sort of.
Let's just be overly simplistic. Jedi.
Yeah, that's about right. They can control... Bene Gesserit can control their body down to the most minute level, to the point that Lady Jessica can control her body so much that she can choose to have a son. I said that earlier. She can choose at the moment of conception to have a son or a daughter. The Bene Gesserit can do Jedi mind tricks with the power of the voice. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's where George got the idea.
Sure, I wouldn't be surprised.
They can control their individual muscles on a level. They can detoxify poison. They can change their blood chemistry. They have complete control of their body down to a cellular level. And a Reverend Mother has access to the memories and experiences of all of her female ancestors.
Not to mention they have telepathy.
Yes, the difference, and they can see into the future. The difference between Paul, who is the Kwisatz Haderach, is that he is the male Bene Gesserit who can not only look back and have the memories of his female ancestors, but his male ancestors, which no female Bene Gesserit has ever been able to access. There's some sexism for you there, Frank.
Yep. So, so then you also have the Spacing Guild, which basically are the ones that control space folding or space travel, light speed, because in this future of an aspect that is not covered, thinking computers are illegal. They're outlawed due to essentially a Terminator type situation.
Correct.
So basically what you have is there's a material of the planet Arrakis, or they call it Dune. It's basically Tatooine. And it is a material called spice, which when you take it, it'll make your life longer. Gives you blue eyes too, but It'll give you visions and can also be used for other things like mutating people to become navigators. So they become these weird alien looking creatures that can navigate space. So to navigate space, you get in your own little spaceship, fly into a navigator tube, and that folds to wherever you're supposed to go. And these guys require spice to do that.
Because they see the safe path. The navigators have prescience, and they can see the future and see outcomes. And so what they found out is, even before the band, after the Butlerian Jihad, when they were fighting the thinking machines, they were originally using navigation computers, but the navigation computers had more mishaps in light speed travel than the navigators. So they went to the navigators. But the navigators used their prescient abilities to see the safe path to fold space. And that's why they're immersed constantly in a spice tank, because it helps enhance those mental abilities and your far-seeing ability, to use another Jedi term.
Yeah. And you also have the Mentats, which are basically human computers.
Correct.
They drink. Is it spice they drink?
No, that is some type of juice. And I got to look up what the Mentats drink, because I've forgotten the name of that juice. But they also, some of them do take spice, but they definitely have, I think it's like, Sappho juice. Sappho or Sappho juice. S-A-P-P-H-O. And it helps enhance their abilities. It probably sounds like futuristic Adderall or speed.
Okay. Yeah, and basically, and they get the red lips and they can make vast calculations. And it seems like they're the advisors to house leaders as well.
Yes, every house leader, Major Duke, has a Mentat. In the book, they are assassins. They're deadly to be feared. They're basically the chief strategist.
Well, it makes sense if they're human computers in a repository of knowledge. So, and then you also have, did the Talaxu even feature in the first book?
I don't think so. I don't think you get into the Talaxu until you get more into Children of Dune and God Emperor.
Okay. So we're not worried about them right now. Just suffice it to say, they're the cloners. They're the Kaminoans of Dune.
Yeah, they show up in Paul of Dune when they bring back Duncan Idaho.
Yeah, like 50 times. But then of course you have these houses that are all vying for power, and the most, I guess, the choicest plum planet of human space would be Arrakis, the planet Dune, because the spice comes from there. It's the only planet that has spice. And so you have, at the beginning of this story, House Harkonnen, which is the, we'll just call it, they're the evil house. That's all there is to it. They're evil at every level. And House Atreides, run by Leto the Just, and they're enemies. Despite the fact Leto married Lady Jessica, who's a Harkonnen, as Scott mentioned earlier. And the Emperor, in an effort to, the House Atreides gets some new kind of weapons, sound-based weapons. So the Emperor, fearing for that balance of power, helps to orchestrate Atreides' overthrow by putting him in charge of Arrakis and then having working with House Harkonnen to take them out. And House Harkonnen is more than happy to do that, because they hate the Atreides. So I think that, oh yes, and of course on the planet Arrakis you have a group of people called the Fremen. They would be essentially the sand people, but they're human. And they ingest spice, and they're like the hippie nomad people of Dune.
Yeah, I would call them more of the, you know, I wouldn't assign a specific group to them, but I would say that they represent more of the fringe groups of society that like to live outside of controlled government, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be your nomad wanderers.
Yeah, they're also the natives of this planet.
Right. I have to correct something. In the book, in the standoff at the end, Paul does threaten to destroy the spice to get the Emperor to stand down. But it's a threat. Yeah.
Was that a bluff, or was that a, I really want to get rid of it?
I feel like Paul might have done it because it would have saved him from the jihad that he knows he can't stop now. The only way to stop it would have been to have no intergalactic travel. And that's the thing. You can't have faster than light speed travel without the spice, because only the navigators can do it. So they're actually the most powerful force in this galaxy until Paul comes around. And that's why they fear Paul, because as I correct myself, I haven't read the book in years. I feel like Paul, it would have been let the cup pass through me moment, where if he destroys the spice, he just could have lived out happily on Arrakis.
Mm-hmm.
But once the Emperor accepted, then everything was set in motion.
Okay. Well, and yeah, that's... there's also the sandworms, which the film doesn't really establish this, but the sandworms help create the spice. And if they get wet, they die, because water is like acid to a sandworm.
Right, which is why it can never rain on Arrakis.
Right.
Or at least not in certain areas. It will rain at some point on Arrakis, but it will never do what, you know,
it's kind of a massive, you know, planet-wide downpour.
Yeah, making Arrakis a terrestrial planet would pretty much destroy everything, because the spice would be gone.
I feel like by the time you get to Heretics of Dune and Chapter House of Dune, it is raining on Arrakis, and the sandworms, there's like a 100-kilometer area of desert, and the sandworms are gone because that's Leto's plan, and when he dies, he'll spawn the new sandworms, and Leto is just holding the hordes of spice, and that's all that's left. So I do think at some point what you see happens, but it's far in the future. Like at the end of Leto's like 4,000 year reign as the God Emperor of Dune.
And as you sickies can see, this is a very complicated series.
Oh my gosh, yeah. It's a huge world building.
You gotta bear with me on this. It's been 7 years since I read a Dune novel. So some of these, you know, 20 novels and 10 to 15,000 pages have just merged together in my mind. There's details that are gone.
Yeah.
There's so much going on in this universe.
Yeah. So let's see. So we have the rain, of course. That's very different from what was happening.
In the first book, it's not raining on Arrakis.
Yeah. Also, I know there's one that Baron Harkonnen, and I don't know why they did this. The Baron Harkonnen, yeah, he's an overweight guy that flies around, but he is not like a grotesque skin lesion guy. he's a guy who needs the suit to fly around, and it is a curse that was given to him by the Bene Gesserit, but the skin disease, I don't know where that came from.
Yeah, I think that was more of David Lynch just trying to show you how despicable of a person this guy is as quickly as possible. Because, you know, he don't have the time. Like, the Baron used to be an in-shape, athletic man until he raped the Reverend Mother. And but she was able to pass on that wasting disease to him, which is why he has to have the doctor, and, you know, and he's overweight and grotesque. She passed that disease on to him as her revenge. But you don't have time to find out how disgusting of a human being the Baron is. So David Lynch has to accelerate that with some visual cues too.
Okay. I know for a fact, too, that the navigators in the film are, well, I don't know what they are. They look like a giant cancer-laden worm with nostrils that shoot lasers. Whereas I remember, and I know this from like the Sci-Fi Channel series, they look just more like... they look more like the Gilman from Creature of the Black Lagoon. They don't look like some floating weird thing. So he got the part right where they're swimming in spice. But then he made him some awful looking thing. I don't know what he was thinking when he decided to do that.
I was going to say one of my picks is I feel like he did a good job with the navigator. They're supposed to be grotesque, deformed humans that have mutated into something unrecognizable and into a different species. the Navigator is one of the tougher things to accurately portray to the screen in this franchise. I don't think that he was terrible with what he did with the Navigators. I think that was one of the better things that he did visually. I actually think visually everything he did with this film is pretty close to spot on.
Oh, well, I mean, what about the weirding ways? In this film, it's like they're like sound wave attacks, where I think in the book they're just like hyper Jedi reflexes and stuff,
yes,
aren't they?
Yes. There's liberties taken with the weirding way, and that's not accurate. That is a departure. It really is just being faster and individual muscle control and biological control to the cellular level.
Except that's something that's easily, you can easily write that in a book, but trying to actually get that across on film is kind of hard. So I can understand why he would do something.
Just hire some wushu masters. Who's going to notice the difference? I mean, that's just what I'm saying there. I think really, as I said, though, everything I just mentioned, the big difference comes when you have in that minute 40 mark where they start to have to really just crank this out. And like the thing about a Reverend Mother with the Fremen is there, but it is so fast that you don't learn anything. And then they just take that left turn of, we need to destroy the spice and we need to put Rain in Arrakis. It just turns into a, wait, what? Not only is it rushed, but it's wrong. So, and I presume that's just because the film time got cut and this is what we're stuck with.
Clarifying a couple things, and I really should have done this before the episode started, so I apologize. But by the time of the God Emperor of Dune, there are no more sandworms on Arrakis, and all spice production has stopped. But that is because Leto, the God Emperor, put humanity on the Golden Path, not Paul. Paul saw the Golden Path but rejected it because he didn't want to metamorphosize into a sandworm. Leto took it, and then when Leto dies, new sand trout are born, which will create a new version of sandworm on Arrakis and allow the spice production to begin again. Apologies.
Okay. Yeah, not confusing at all.
No.
Not at all. So I think with all that kind of backstory in the way, let's just get into our rips and picks of this film, and then we'll, of course, rate it. But my first rip would be that the sound editing sucks.
Oh, boy.
You go from scenes of where I had to crank the volume up to 40 so I could hear their inner monologue, and then it would go to an explosion. And at one point, my wife was screaming at me, how loud do you need that thing? And I was thinking, loud, because it would oscillate. So in the middle of big music and guitars and explosions, and then, oh, baby Jessica's Bene Gesserit. Oh, they're going to teach me how to use a sandworm. I use a thumper, and this sound attracts these tremors. I mean sandworms, the graboids, and then I ride it. Oh, that's what's going to happen. I don't know what these people are. It reminds me of a Christopher Nolan movie. No sound editing used. So that's one rip for me.
The sound editing was terrible. The sound selection was terrible. The sounds the shields make. I mean, there's nothing good sound-wise in this film. So I'll agree with you on that. It's absolutely god-awful.
So that's my first rip.
Sound-wise, I agree with you. That's an easy one.
Yeah.
There is other issues, I think. There's some exploitation being done here at points. It's like, oh, do we really need to? I get where you're going.
My biggest rip with this would be there's the exposition is ham-handed, and it never stops. There has to be a lot of exposition, but this exposition is terrible. And it's not a play. We should not be having soliloquies from almost every character. It's horrendous. I don't need to be hearing the character's thoughts repeatedly and to hear simple things like, she's using the voice. I must resist. My son is alive. These things, show it. Don't tell it. It's a tough film to write, but if you're not willing to take on that challenge, don't do it. Because if you have to resort to 35% of the first hour of the film being exposition in the form of monologues or soliloquies, you failed. You've created a film that nobody wants to watch. So that's my biggest rip with this movie. My second biggest rip would be that there is a horrific underuse of the talents of Patrick Stewart as Gurney Halleck.
Good point. Good point.
I think it tells you how bad the writing is, that the cast of this film is actually very good, and no one has turned in a good performance. Maybe Dean Stockwell as Yui. Al. He didn't have Ziggy, but Dean Stockwell might have gave the best performance, and that's not because he's the best actor in the film. It's because his lines were probably closest to the best. But when even Patrick Stewart can't do much with what you've given him, you have a problem. You wrote a terrible film.
Yeah. Patrick Stewart, yeah. Yeah. Wow.
And another one I would say is, I understand with the shield, the personal shields, I get they wanted to do that, but if... And given the limitations, you couldn't do it as well as, say, sci-fi well. But when you look at how they are, it looks like two people in a glob of jello. And I can't believe that someone in the editing process didn't look at that and go, is there another way we can do this?
Yeah, that was god-awful. I was going to bring that one up. I'm glad you brought that up.
It looked like two blobs of jello bashing into each other.
It looked like an 8-bit fight on Nintendo, or maybe even Atari.
Atari Jello. The only thing it needed to be doing was going doo 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 doo
doo. And the problem is that's an essential scene. The slow blade gets through because the shield is going to stop anything moving at a certain speed. And then they completely screw up and let Duncan Idaho get killed by a bullet to the head that gets through the shield. The slow blade gets through, or the fast bullet.
I'm glad you said that, because I thought the same thing. Like, wait a minute. I thought, first of all, Duncan took out a ton of Sardaukar warriors.
At least 20.
And not only that. Huh?
At least 20, which is amazing to take out one. Yeah.
And so, not only that, though, doesn't he get killed by an explosion or something?
Duncan is buying time, and he gets killed, if I remember correctly, in a corner in a hallway fighting. And I think you find out in Paul of Dune that it took 20 of them to take him down. It was a poor scene, and it makes no sense, because that fight between Gurney and Paul is very important, and it's one of the mantras, and it forms Paul's training, and it's a terrible scene, and you lose the most important part of it, which is we'd have joined each other in death, and then it's undone entirely by the fact that a bullet gets through the shield to kill Duncan. The reason you don't use guns, because the shield will stop them. Use a sword. And the crazy thing about it is you're trying to swing the sword fast enough to get past your opponent's guard, but slow enough to get through the shield.
Which is supposed to be tricky.
And that would create, if you're world building, a martial art unto itself.
Correct. And that is also why it becomes very, very difficult in 1984 and even in other, even in the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries to show combat in this, because you've created a situation that makes war almost an impossibility. Like, every single person is walking around with a mutually assured destruction belt. And then the shield is so effective that it's almost impossible to kill them. You've got to have like hours to have a fight and hopefully get lucky enough to sneak through the shield and kill them. So then how do you actually get to these wars?
Which explains why you don't have a lot of wars, because if you've made it that difficult, why do it?
Right. Plus, you need the tacit approval of the Spacing Guild to have a war, because someone's got to transport your troops there. And if it's getting too disruptive, the Spacing Guild is like, nope, nope.
You are not allowed to have a war. You're causing too much trade disputes.
Oh, you guys can declare war all you want, but how are you going to get your troops there?
You can be at war for as long as you want, but you're never fighting because we're not transporting them.
Right.
Right. So that and interesting points that didn't get brought up. But, so we're not ripping on everything. I would say one of the things I liked was Paul's sister, Arya. Arya?
Alia.
Did I say it?
Alia. Yes, that is an excellent portrayal.
She did a very good job. She rivals the one from the sci-fi panel. They're both very good. I couldn't pick. But I think the only reason I like the sci-fi channel one better, and we'll see why, is the dialogue in the sci-fi channel one is creepier.
Yeah, and that is such a tough role to play for an experienced actress, let alone a child actor.
Absolutely.
Because
you're talking about a girl who was born with the memory of every single Bene Gesserit in her.
Right. Every ancestor she ever had in the womb, she became aware. So you've got a fetus in the womb with the memories of every female ancestor she ever had.
And on top of it, the Reverend Mother for the Fremen told Lady Jessica, "You didn't tell us you were pregnant.
Yep.
This is going to complicate things."
Yeah, like they never put them through the water of life because basically, Alia became a Reverend Mother before she was born.
Well,
right.
Which causes so many issues. I mean, you're being born now with basically being able to speak because you have knowledge. It's like, what?
You're able, right. The only thing you're waiting for to be able to speak is your vocal cords to be fully formed enough to, you know, make the sounds.
I also would like to say that the effects are quite good given the time. There's a little bit of H.R. Geiger in there. And I like the spaceships, how they look. And honestly, one of the coolest things is the still suits.
Yes.
In fact, those were so cool. They're winding up in the new film.
Yes.
So, but just little things they make mention, like when Paul puts a still suit on and they're like, oh, that's you got it ready for the desert. You've done this before. No, I just did it the way I felt right. So
I think
it was laying those seeds that Paul knew more than he thought he knew.
Correct. And I think one of the picks that I will give this first off is I think it's largely true to the novel. Where it deviates at the end, it has to for time. But I think it's largely loyal enough to the novel that I really can't get angry that it wasn't, you know, like you can with, like, say, J.J. Abrams. But, you know, it's true enough that I don't think Frank Herbert would have been upset by what ended up being on screen. I think visually, it's a fantastic recreation of the Dune universe. I feel like this is what it would look like. I feel that they got the setting right. I think they got the world right. And it, you know, as much as they could with 1984 technology, it's supposed to look, you're getting a humanity that doesn't have computers and machines that can calculate and think, any type of artificial intelligence. So you see mechanical contrivances, sure. But you see only the mechanical contrivances you would have had before the computerized age. And you're getting this mixed type of society that has these modern conveniences, but only to a certain level. And you're seeing a blending of a feudal culture and a feudal economy and that type of government and an empire with modernity. And I think he's pretty faithful to that vision. And I gotta give him credit for that, because it's tough to portray a lot of what's going on in Dune, because it's a very unique universe to that aspect.
He gets the point across that he needs to get across. I mean, he gets you the into the universe, which, yeah, again, you're absolutely right, is hard to do.
You know, though, I do, and I'm comparing this to the next week already. I shouldn't be, but I am. I really don't like Baron Harkonnen as much in this, because he's not the political schemer. He's just a guy that floats around going and screams and spits. And it's like, this is not a political schemer. Are we sure someone forgot to tell him that, hey, you're not Raban, you're Vladimir?
Well,
it just seems a bit like they're trying to make him more of a beast than a schemer. And that just doesn't. And a weirdo, like, what was that scene where he's covered in oil? What was that about?
You know, they're trying to show you again. They're trying to show you the greasy, you know, predator that is Baron Harkonnen. And they do a good job with the terror that, you know, his serving boys are showing when they're, oh, please don't come towards me. And they're giving you that with the setting and reading the subtext and the visual cues. But I agree with you entirely that the guy who plays Baron Harkonnen in the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries is much better at it and is the definitive role and portrayal of that. And when I read the books, I see that guy and I hear that voice more than I hear this guy. He was more into the creepy hedonism side of the Baron than the deep thinking, manipulative mastermind Baron Harkonnen that gets portrayed in next week's series. But that could also be because he has more time to do it. The mantra of the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries that we're going to see next week is the saga of Dune is far from over. And oh yeah, it's always far from over. I better start watching it now to be able to talk about it next week. But it's good, so I don't mind.
So yeah, I mean, I just don't see a Baron who played the game, intrigued, and loved playing the game. I see a guy that's just gross.
Yeah, I get that. And I think it's, again, the time constraints.
It must be.
It's probably also the direction David Lynch gave.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, also just look at, like, Fade. Fade was more or less just a guy that showed up every once in a while, made a mention that he hates the Atreides and hates Paul. We're not sure why, but he does. And then, oh, at the end they fight.
Yeah. Fade Rautha is the most useless character ever.
I just, you know, again, going to the Sci-Fi series, there's a lot more. You see the rivalry. Fade is a major character. Whereas in this, it's almost like, well, we don't have a lot of time and we need to do something big with this character. Ooh, Sting's popular. Let's get him. And I'm presuming that Sting is not a half bad actor. I've seen him in other films where he did pretty well, like Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, but he actually had a bigger role in that.
He's done fine acting.
Yeah, he just wasn't given anything in this film. So I can't really go at him. And also another thing that rips for me, it's just weird. I mean, I realized that there were some acid trips when writing this or inspiring it, but it just seems to me that unless you're deliberately trying to cater to the whoa man crowd, depicting your acid warp generally doesn't work out because only you got it, if that. So I don't know how depicting all the visions was necessarily helpful, because again, you maybe get your little acid warp, probably not, but let's just say you do. We don't. So that was just something for me, a rip.
Fair enough.
I got a rip. More dialogue.
Oh, you got one left?
Oh. I am the Shout-Out Mapes. Who introduces himself like this? I'm the Shout-Out Mapes, the housekeeper. How about this? I'm Mapes. I'm your housekeeper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, again, who knows in this universe? Maybe that's the standard. Be a housekeeper. They're supposed to do that.
Yeah, everyone's supposed to introduce themselves in dramatic fashion. I am the Rage Master.
Oh, I shall be your podcaster today.
Yeah.
You're the Shout Out Mapes? The Shade Out Mapes? I'm the Sunny in Scott. I don't know. What's a shade out?
Yeah.
Is this supposed to mean something to me? I mean, it must, because you used a creepy title.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are there any more rips and picks we want to do before we give our final before we give our final evaluation?
I can't think of any others.
Yeah, I think I'd lay out the big ones that were on my mind.
Yeah, I think it's mostly just bad dialogue and too much soliloquies.
Well, in that case, why don't you start us off with the rating? Let's say, how many Gom Jabbars are you going to give this? How many Atreides Gom Jabbars?
3. It's nearly unwatchable. Other than a visual depiction of the world so that you can, you know, visualize what you've read, it's almost unwatchable. It's poorly written. It's poorly acted, which is amazing considering there's a lot of good actors in it, but I can't even give Patrick Stewart a good grade for his acting in this. This is probably one of the worst performances of Patrick Stewart's career. And it's because he doesn't have anything to work with. It's a excellent cast, and nobody pulls it off. I can't give a good grade acting-wise to anybody in this. There's nothing good to work with. Too much exposition. Too much ham-handed exposition. Too much telling us instead of showing us. And as stupid as this sounds, the story's rushed. At 2 hours and 17 minutes, it's rushed. And so you get a condensed, crappy version of a really good story. And you get moments where they've reached too far with, like, the boxy Atari Jello shield fight. And then you get moments where they don't go far enough. And then they contradict themselves. Shields work this way, and then they don't. But that's minor stuff. Largely, it's just unwatchable. It's unwatchable with dialogue that makes Anakin and Padme's love conversation seem like the gold standard in a masterclass in writing dialogue. Not enough stuff is explained. And if you haven't read the book, this movie won't make sense to you at all. And all of that's a failure. And I can't blame David Lynch for having this movie released under his pseudonames like Judas Beach, because I wouldn't want my name attached to this either. And it isn't a project that I would ever take on. Not that anyone would ever offer it to me, but if I was a director or a writer or involved in film, I wouldn't take on Dune in a movie because it can't be done. It cannot be done right in a 2 to 3 hour movie. It has to be a mini series or a TV series type of deal to do it correctly. And you'd need a huge budget. And while I'm praying that Dune 2021 is good, I don't have high expectations because I don't think that it's the material that's bad. I think it's the time constraint. So I'll give this a 3 because I like Dune and I will probably never watch this version of Dune again in my life.
Wow. I'm going to give it a worse rating, actually.
Wow. 2.
Reasons being basically what Scott said, but also I'm not as much of a diehard Dune fan as Scott is.
Oh, okay.
And I did watch this in the past, and rewatching it was, wow, I forgot how bad it was. And I was like, oh yeah, there's a reason why I haven't gone back to this or even wanted to. Because, yeah, it's not that great. And it's tedious at times. And if I'm watching a film, I don't want it to be tedious. I'm sorry.
That's a point. I was going to give it 4 or 5 because the first half, let's say, the first hour and 20 minutes is, I guess, good enough. But the monologues kill it. The soliloquies kill it. The exposition kills it. I cannot stand the bushy eyebrows of the Mentats. And just other things that everything Scott said. That it became rushed, and really, I don't know what else. Everything I wanted to say, Scott kind of said, but it was enjoyable enough to watch at least once. So if you're interested in Dune, I would say watch it at least once. And then head on over to the Sci-Fi Channel's Dune, which is what we'll be doing next week. That one is far better. And yes, the production value is cheaper, but the effects are somehow better because of modern technology. Well, more modern technology when they made it. But also, given the length, they were able to stay closer to the book, which we'll talk about more.
It's better written. It's better acted. The portrayals. I mean, it's all around the better product. I joked around in last week's show notes about a month of deep meaning. I don't think I'm going to do any deep meaning in the individual week episodes. But I may come up with a supplemental for just the deep meaning of Dune.
Okay. Well, that maybe would be also good. Yeah, we'll see. But amazingly, when we get to it, this was not the worst film adaptation of Dune, at least not the worst planned one. When we get to Jaworski's Dune, you'll find out that, no, David Lynch's version makes Jaworski's look. I mean, Jaworski's version makes David Lynch's look downright accurate and fantastic. So,
to be fair, I don't blame David Lynch for anything here. I think he did the best he could do in a time constraint and a budget constraint and technology of the time constraint. I don't blame him.
No, he did very well, especially for, again, the money he was given, the time restraint, and especially the technology.
I just think he was in a no-win scenario. I think anyone trying to put this film into a two-hour or three-hour block is in a no-win scenario. You're going to be forced into bad exposition dumps and leaving things unexplained and rushing certain elements that can't be rushed to really get what you need to get out of this story, which is about the evolution of the human being and bettering the man rather than creating technology to advance man. And you can't rush that. You can't get what you need to out of the Bene Gesserit. And here I go doing deep meaning. But the great part about this story is showing the capability of evolving and advancing humanity rather than creating technology to advance humanity and letting us stagnate. And you can't rush that. This is really an exploration of our own capability to move forward, but our own anchoring of holding ourselves back by our petty divisions and squabblings and infighting and greed, which is where you get the Spacing Guild and the Great Houses and the Landsraad and the political infighting and the debauchery of the Baron played against the idealism of Leto. Anytime you try to fit this all into a 2 or 3 hour presentation, you're going to lose everything that gives this story any meaning.
Well, I was trying to recommend it at least minor, and Scott shot that down, but whatever.
Sorry, Mark. Look, watch it for the visualization.
Yeah, watch it just so you could say you've seen it once at least, and then go to the Sci-Fi Channel one, and then hopefully next year you'll get to see the one with Denis. But it sounds like I'm pulling an episode 8 here and like closing the month before we've even begun it. So, wow, good job. Thanks a lot, Ryan Johnson. You killed it again. Anyway, if anybody wants to comment on Dune or comment on anything we've said, they can do so at
www.ravinglunaticmedia.com, ravinglunaticmedia.com, ravinglunaticmedia.com, not glowing finger in a sex jacuzzi.
Okay.
What's left for them to do, Rage Master?
Stay sick, sickies.